Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. If you're a sports fan, you've no doubt done years of mental gymnastics, trying to imagine an alternate universe in which Bill Buckner stops a World Series grounder, Butler sinks a buzzer beater in the NCAA championship game, or Wally Pipp decides to stick it out at first base. My guest Mike Pesca of the podcast The Gist is more interested in even bigger alternate realities. A frequently heard voice on these airwaves, the longtime NPR sports reporter is out with a new book, Upon Further Review, The Greatest What-Ifs in Sports History. In it, he has gathered a murderer's row of sports writers and other cultural critics to probe at some of the underlying issues that link society and sports. Mike Pesca, welcome to the roundtable.
Thanks for having me.
So what got you thinking about this line of inquiry in sports?
Well, I think it was being a fan and being a reporter. So for NPR for 7 years, I went to Final Fours and World Series and Super Bowls, and it was great. At the end of every game, there'd be confetti, and fans would be celebrating, and players would be hugging, and trophies would be hoisted. And I started thinking a little bit about my own fandom. Yes, we separate this when we cover the job, but still, it's hard not to have the emotional response. And, you know, I'm from New York, and I could have been a Yankees fan, but I was raised a Mets fan, and I could have been a Giants fan, but I was raised a Jets fan, and that fact alone has robbed me of something like 15 championships in my lifetime. In fact, as a Mets, Jets, Knicks, and St. John's fan, I personally only got to experience one championship as a cognizant human, and I began to say, well, what if? How would this have felt differently? What were the things that went wrong with my teams? And as I festered on that for a little bit, the idea for the book became clear, and the key was to focus it a little bit more than to say, oh, if this call had gone the other way or if this draft pick had been redone, to focus it and to have structure on this undertaking of sports what-ifs.
We'll get to some of the deeper questions, but speaking of your years of no championships, are you addicted as a fan to the pain of that?
No, I feel like I've perfected fandom, and it's very off-putting when I say that to people, but I don't really experience too many of the lows. Maybe this is just how I am as a person. And when you get older, maybe when you're a teenager or a young adult, these things seem to hurt more, though I listen to a lot of sports talk radio, and there seems like there are plenty of 60- and 70-year-olds who've never gotten over, you know, Buckner missing the ball or any of the other things we're talking about. So I really don't... It doesn't hurt me so much when my team does poorly, when my team does well, which is occasionally, you know, the Mets made the World Series a couple years ago. I get a lot of pleasure out of it. I'm disappointed when they lose based on perhaps a poorly timed throw from first to home, but I'll get over it the next day. Maybe it's because I did all this reporting and I saw so much joy in so many other teams, or maybe it's that I know that there is my own self-worth is not so tied up to the teams themselves.
How do you think the Supreme Court ruling that will basically allow the states to proceed with legalized sports betting might influence the way people are fans of these games?
Well, I will say this, and I'll say it as a what if. I think going forward, it will probably be fine. Let me carve out one proviso. If they allow gambling on very minor leagues where people aren't paid that much, and we saw this in international tennis matches in Croatia being bet on by people in London, that could affect the outcomes of games. But I do think that the leagues have matured and that there's so much money in the leagues that things will be fine. And in fact, there's always some percentage of people, a non-trivial percentage, that will be addicted. But I do think that it will make boring games a little more exciting. However, if you ask me, what if there always was legalized sports betting? I think things would have changed a lot. And I think especially before all the big money got into sports and before the average salary in the NBA was well over $1 million, I do think there would be an opportunity for sports to have been sullied by a gambling scandal. We saw that with the 1919 White Sox, and it wouldn't have surprised me if it was just game on since the 1920s. It wouldn't have surprised me if every sport didn't have its own gambling scandal, which is to say there was a logic for the ban. At one point, I think that society and the pay of professional athletes has changed so much that undoing the ban is the right decision.
And the leagues have gone from, as you say, they've matured from, you know, avoiding Las Vegas at all costs to wanting a seat at the table here.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of our, we have a lot of what ifs in the book. For instance, the second one is Jason Gay saying, what if there was no professional football because football was deemed too boring in 1899? And a lot of it redounds on freeing up our Sundays and putting a big dent in the foam finger industry, sure. But but the entire, you know, structure of the leagues has changed and exploded from, you know, Frank DeFord used to talk about he was friendly with the players in NBA teams because they would have to take two connecting flights to get to each game. So there were just tons of downtime. And also as a reporter, he had a bigger expense account than the players. So things are totally different from how they used to be.
Well, one of the big questions with the sports betting is what to do about the NCAA tournament. That seems to be the one place where there is a lot of gray area. Technically, they're amateur athletes, and the NCAA is a multi-billion dollar concern. So how do you handle that?
Well, the answer in the book is something like Jonathan Hawk's essay, What If Jerry Tarkanian Had Beaten the NCAA? And he's the famous coach of UNLV who got into a lawsuit, and it didn't really upend things that much in basketball. But what if, you know, what if college basketball, what if amateur basketball or minor league basketball affiliated with colleges, what if you could pay the players? Because guess what? They essentially do pay the players in lots of ways. I don't think the sport would be that different. So, to your question, how will the presence of professional gambling affect NCAA basketball? I think they have to watch it. I think that a lot of the places, a lot of the states, because it doesn't mean tomorrow there'll be professional gambling, but some states will allow it, and some states have a 2-year window, and some states have a 5-year window. Perhaps many states will not allow it. Perhaps many states will not allow wagering on the in-state team. For instance, you can't wager on the Las Vegas Golden Knights in many Las Vegas, if not all Las Vegas casinos. So perhaps there'll be a carve-out for that, but I would look a little bit at the danger of that. One last thing. If there is any sort of chicanery, if players are bought off, the fact that there's legalized gambling, that could help investigators figure out that a player is bought off. They might see weird fluctuations on who's putting bets on odd games, and that actually has happened in the past. And actual investigations have been spurred by the casinos saying, wow, there's a lot of action on this Arizona State game in December, and that has led to scandals.
We're talking with Mike Pesca about the new book, Upon Further Review, The Greatest What-Ifs in Sports History. Take us through a couple of your favorite arguments in the book.
Well, what I really wanted to do was have a lot of different tones and a lot of different sports and a lot of different eras. And there's a tie-in podcast, also called Upon Further Review, that takes 5 of the chapters. And when I say different tones, it does one of the chapters as straight reporting. That's Leon Neyfakh talking about what if Richard Nixon were good at football. Totally changes his personality. There's another pretty straight report there talking about what if Brandi Chastain had missed the kick in the 1999 Women's World Cup. But the last of those is a fake Boston sports talk radio show where Tom Brady never took over for the Patriots, and it's just two miserable guys from Boston bemoaning the fact that the New England Patriots have been bad for the last 20 years. And if you really want to talk about different tone, in the book, Robert Siegel, late of NPR, wrote the essay about the Dodgers leaving Brooklyn, and we pulled him out of retirement, and he reports that piece. So if you've missed Robert Siegel on your air, episode 3 of the podcast is Robert Siegel doing pretty much a straight-up NPR report, except it imagines that the Dodgers are still in Brooklyn in the year 2018, and this is the first time that they're leaving town.
Right. And of course, we all do miss hearing him on All Things Considered. We should note that there's an editor's note on that essay saying, you know, we know that the Dodgers did leave, but here's another viewpoint.
Yeah, the idea is he's reporting from an alternative reality where things look basically the same, but the year is 2018, and there's still this team named the Dodgers playing at Ebbets Field in Brooklyn, but it is 2019 that they've been lured out west. So some things change. I don't want to give too much away, but maybe Chuck Schumer was the mayor of New York instead of the U.S. senator. That's one of the things that would have changed.
So how did you get involved in sports fandom and sports reporting eventually?
you're just born to it, right? Your dad tells you about it and you go to a game and then maybe it's 1986 and the Mets do win the World Series and you are hooked. I actually liked football and basketball. Those were my two favorite sports and I liked playing sports. And how I got into sports reporting, it's funny, in the acknowledgments, I thank all the guys I went to high school with who are just gigantic sports fans. And then I got out into the world and I always considered myself, yeah, fairly well-informed sports fan. And then people would talk to me and they'd say, you know everything about sports. And I would think, well, I'm about like 8th in my high school graduating class. There were some obsessives there. So I get to NPR and they say pitch stories. And I would pitch stories about, you know, local city council meetings and some study that came out of Yale and also some sports stories. And they would say, yeah, we got someone on the Yale story. The city council meeting's a little too small. But tell me again about High Lie or whatever it was. Why don't you go to the World Series of Grass Drag Racing? Or I did not know that a player so short was playing second base for the Astros. So all my sports stories were met with great enthusiasm. And they said, you know what, Mike, become a sports reporter. And I said, yes.
I loved hearing your sports reports all those years on NPR. But some people would say that NPR sports reporting is a bit of an oxymoron. Did you find yourself in clubhouses and locker rooms having to sort of justify your existence there sometimes?
Luckily, it turns out that the sophomore at Butler wasn't even that aware of NPR, so I could have said anything. The analogy I always make is it's like being the opera reporter for ESPN, the sports reporter for NPR. But actually, as you know, NPR has the biggest radio audience. They're a really smart audience. All the listeners might not be that into or oriented towards sports, but they're curious people. And if you spark their curiosity in ways other than talking about game-winning RBIs or, you know, on-base percentage, there's a real opportunity to communicate. And I do think telling stories are telling stories. And if the stories happen to take place on a field or on a court or on the ice, there's still stories about human beings. And there's a way to hook people with interesting things that they might not have thought of. The other side to that is I always used to, before I was a sports reporter on NPR, I would listen to NPR and hear how they did sports. And I always felt it was a little remedial. In fact, if you compare, say, NPR sports reporting to their international reporting or their national reporting, I mean, their international reporting seems at least on a sophomore level and their sports reporting seemed about on a fourth grade level. So I wanted to take it to the sophomore level. What I'm saying is I brought a sophomoric sensibility to NPR sports reporting.
So your book is about what ifs. You and I have something ignominious in common, which is we were both one day Jeopardy players.
Oh, yeah.
Were you at all crushed after that result?
Well, I would have been, but I don't know if you know this, but I was I missed an extra point in Super Bowl 51, and that couldn't. Oh, no, no. So tell me, I think a lot of the ignominy tends to redound to exactly how the game went. And I was in first place going into Final Jeopardy. And it was a name two of the four people. And I named one. And I had the other one on my board and crossed it out. The other one being Barbara Streisand. So I came so close. And there is a sports analogy. Is it better to lose by 25 or lose at the last second? If you lose at the last second, I think you are gutted as I was. And I could not watch Jeopardy for literally, I did not willingly watch Jeopardy until my kids came around. So that's maybe about, I don't know, 8 years. But how did you deal with your foray?
It was the same thing. You know, honestly, I had been working on it for so long. I was pretty obsessive about getting there. So once there was over, there was this weird hole.
The one thing I do like watching, I like Jeopardy now, and the one thing I like about it is a lot of people wager very stupidly in the finals. I think I can, people know to at least cover the bet of the guy in first place, but there's a lot of very poor strategery, if you will, on the wagering. I think I could be a consultant on that.
Back to sports for a minute. What do you think are some of the biggest issues facing the sports world today? You know, things that you'd like to see changed?
Well, one of the big issues is right there in an essay, What If Football Were Reinvented Today? And I had Nate Jackson write the essay. He's a former NFL player, played primarily for the Broncos. And the deal is a couple things. Brain injury, obviously, you have to take that into account. He just notes that the game is a little static and a little sclerotic. And if you compare what football has become, which is one guy throwing the ball, and that guy's often the least athletic guy on the field, not to denigrate Tom Brady and a lot of other quarterbacks. Nick Foles is a great athlete. But, you know, compared to the guys who are catching the ball or running with the ball or a bunch of the guys like Gronkowski who are doing a little blocking and a little catching, yeah, Tom Brady is less of an athlete than those guys. I think we saw that this year when he tried to catch a pass. But he's protected by these obese offensive linemen, and it leads to injury. It leads to bad life outcomes for the offensive linemen who weigh too much and get hit in the head too much. It leads to bad outcomes for the quarterback who keeps getting concussed and knocked down. So Nate's idea is, what if you turn everyone into sort of a Swiss Army knife and allow all different players to throw the ball and kind of break up the idea of establishing a pocket and these five gigantic offensive linemen? It's at least something interesting to think about, you know?
Yeah, and the way the sport is, I mean, it grips the country every week. We all watch the Super Bowl, and yet it does seem unsustainable in a way once you find out about the damage the CTE is doing to people.
Yeah, and, you know, as far as gripping the nation once a week, that gets to another essay, which is Will Leach, founder of Deadspin, wrote an essay, What If Baseball Were Played Once a Week? So I call it the greatest sports what ifs. This is an idea that I think few people have even considered, but one of the joys of that essay is, okay, I hadn't thought of it beforehand, what would happen? And then when you begin to think about it, the ripple effects are pretty interesting. So when I often say, if people ask, why is football so popular? The answer is violence, because it's a violent game. And what people hear in that answer is, oh, yes, Americans like violence. And also sometimes the violence is thrilling. And I don't actually mean that. What I mean is, it's so violent, you can't play it more than once a week. And because of the scarcity, that is, I think, the biggest driver of football's popularity. There's the buildup for a week. There's the fact that you're not overly inundated with football. I mean, we tailgate before football games. Baseball games are played at 1 o'clock on a Sunday. There's very little tailgating that goes along with that. So what Will does is he paints this scenario of a once-a-week baseball game, and then baseball becomes more special, and you talk about a game for a week, and we need about 150 fewer pitchers in the game. That is an interesting byproduct. So that's one of those essays where you might not have thought about it beforehand, but now you do. Kind of interesting.
My big what if as a Knicks fan, a fellow Knicks fan, is, you know, what if they win the game 7 against the Rockets? Still hurts. What do you think of the new coach, Coach Fizdale, and the state of the franchise right now?
I think Fizdale's a good coach, and I think it doesn't matter. I think that Brad Stevens could not coach this team to consistent playoff success. I think they have dysfunction stemming from the ownership. All the good teams have owners who are forward-looking. If you look at the Spurs and the Rockets and the Warriors, these are all owners who embrace a new ideas and a new form of basketball, and there just seems to be a rot from the top down as regards the Dolan family and the Knicks. So I really wonder about the Knicks and ever getting out of their own way. And the last thing I will say is, in addition to the Upon Further Review podcast, I have a podcast called The Gist. And just this week, we talked about Becky Hammon of San Antonio getting a spot to coach a team. Why not, when you have a team like the Knicks, why not roll the dice on the first female coach? That would be the greatest thing ever. The fact that she wasn't even brought in for an interview, and she was interviewed by the Bucks, and I think she's going to be interviewed by the Pistons. The fact that she wasn't brought in for an interview, Fizdale's a fine coach, but it shows that you're not really being aggressive and creative.
I guess we should listen to some of James Dolan's blues bar band on the way out of this interview.
As we do, I have one last question for you. You ready? Who completed his last painting, a canvas called Driftwood?
I will never not know this for the rest of my life. Winslow Homer. Mike Pesca is the author of Upon Further Review, The Greatest What Ifs in Sports History, and the host of the podcast The Gist. I've been a fan of yours for as long as I've been working here and hearing you regularly, and it's just been a pleasure to have you in my own headphones for a change. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Close your eyes and just glide.